Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Do human beings have an innate cognitive tendency to believe in God? Or is religion and the belief in the supernatural merely something that is taught to us by our cultural institutions, including family, schools, and churches? The answer to those questions can have profound implications for the nature of belief in society, whether secularization is an inevitability in modern life, and how we go about understanding and practicing our spiritual faith. To address these questions and issues, I am pleased to welcome Professor Justin Barrett, a professor of psychology and the Thrive Chair for Applied Developmental Science at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California, and who was recently a senior researcher at Oxford Center for Anthropology and Mind. Now that's Oxford University in Great Britain, the one with the ox and the Ford. Dr. Barrett specializes in the study of cognitive development, with specific attention to how cognition relates to religion, and is the author of nearly 1 billion articles as well as several books, including Why Would Anyone Believe in God? Cognitive Science, Religion, and Theology, From Human Minds to Divine Minds, which recently was published, and The Science of Childhood Religion, which will be released in early 2012 with the Free Press. As usual, we'll link to all of those books on our website. Professor Barrett has also served as the co-area director for Young Life in Lawrence, Kansas. Justin, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks very much.
First off, how is it that you wrote almost a billion articles?
I mean, I think there's a little exaggeration going on.
No, I don't know. Your vita is pretty long. I mean, we're roughly the same age, and my vita really pales in comparison to yours. So I got to know how you write so many articles.
I think it's quality versus quantity, maybe.
I don't know. These are some good stuff that we're going to be talking about here, too. The other thing I got to mention, I mentioned this in the introduction about Oxford University in Great Britain. I said that it's the place with the ox and the Ford. I know this because I visited Oxford University, and there is an ox and there is a Ford or a bridge where you can actually visit. I don't know. Have you seen that? Must have.
I'm not sure which Ford you're referring to. There are a number.
Okay.
It's where two rivers come together. So it's sort of low marshy land that no one other than scholars really wanted.
Yeah. Well, I noticed there was an ox by the Ford when I saw that one time, and I'm pretty impressed by that because I have a pair of cufflinks from Oxford, and to impress my colleagues, I have those cufflinks on. Sometimes they say, "Oh, you were at Oxford?" I said, "Oh, yes." I don't tell them I was only a tourist, so I'll just let their mind wander and think that I was actually a scholar there. But So anyways, I should mention that I did first meet Justin at a recent conference at Princeton Theological Seminary, where I was invited, and I was pretty much largely invisible to the audience because of my sparse curriculum vita, but I really took notice of Justin and had to write down a note that he had to be interviewed for this podcast because he said some things that just really wowed me. And I must admit that I am not an expert on psychology, let alone cognitive development, and being a political economist who focuses on external costs and benefits as determinants of human behavior, I've always had some degree of skepticism of the academic discipline of psychology. But Justin at this conference made some really interesting arguments and presented some very convincing evidence about the psychology of religious belief, and that's what I want to dig into right now. Now, the basic conclusion of much of your research is that human beings from birth, or we should say almost from birth, have a natural inclination to believe in the supernatural. And now, in one of your papers that I just read, you state this as the naturalness of religion and the unnaturalness of theology, which is certainly a provocative title. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if I would have called it the naturalness of religion as much as the naturalness of a belief in God. So I want to start by pressing you on some definitional terms here, starting with the word religion. When you say naturalness of religion, what do you mean by religion?
That's a good question. I use the term religion in at least most of my writing as shorthand for a whole cluster of ideas that we generally think of as religious sorts of ideas. Belief in God, belief, or at least some kind of a God, belief in an afterlife, maybe belief in something like a soul or a separable part of a human from their body, and other kinds of ideas like that. And then those behaviors that spring out as expressions of those beliefs or are motivated by those kinds of beliefs. So you're right. I'm not making very strong claims about institutions or structures the way that you might from other disciplinary perspectives.
Yeah, that's one thing that it struck me, and I think this is a difference in our disciplines to some extent, because when I use the term religion, I do study institutions. I study churches and denominations and congregations. So usually religion for me comes up with that scaffolding, a term that you use quite effectively throughout much of your work, the scaffolding around these beliefs. So what we're talking here when we talk about religion is belief. And this is important for our audience to remember as well, because I know there's a lot of people out there who are might be disillusioned with religion, and they are thinking in terms of institutional religion, but yet they still call themselves spiritual. And so you're talking religion in terms of that belief or spiritual beliefs?
Well, beliefs and some of the behaviors that spring from those beliefs.
Okay.
But you're right. The focus is more, sometimes for lack of a better term, we talk about religion on the hoof or, you know, the sort of more of the personal level, more, I don't want to say entirely individual, but certainly more religion on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you define as theology? Because you use that in the title of the article as well, the naturalness of religion and the unnaturalness of theology. What's your definition of theology?
Yeah, in this context, I take theology to be a reflective exercise, an attempt to sort of intellectually elaborate our religious intuition and arrive at certain kinds of truths about these other sorts of ideas that I'm calling religious.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of this reflective kind of disaffected intellectual exercise.
Okay, that, and I buy that too. It's structuring our beliefs in a more intellectualized fashion.
Yeah, and so one of the contrasts that becomes important is that most people around the world, and probably throughout human history, have been religious to one degree or another and exercised that. But that doesn't mean we all do theology. In fact, probably very few of us spend much time in theological thought.
Yeah, my pastor would say that about me. most definitely. He said, hey, you know, you're religious, but you got to kind of work on figuring out what it's all about. And I said, okay. Now, you mentioned just a second ago that people all around the world have this inclination toward religion. And that brings up this issue of naturalness or the instinctiveness of religion. Now, in the field of cognitive psychology, what do you mean by something being natural or this naturalness?
Yeah, I'm using a very specific sense of naturalness here. I've actually stolen this from a philosopher of cognitive science, Robert McCauley at Emory University. I think he's very helpfully laid out this sort of idea of what you might think of, well, what we call cognitive naturalness. And this is a characteristic or a mode of expression characterized by ease, automaticity, fluency. So it's something we can do without thinking too hard. It's something that doesn't take lots of concentration. It comes naturally to us. So Macaulay is sort of borrowing on the folk sense of, at least one folk sense of natural. Like, wow, he's just a natural basketball player. It means he doesn't have to think about it. He can just swish those jump shots, and he doesn't have to sort of get himself all into a bother about it. Or he's a natural chess player. Again, he doesn't have to think too hard about it. He can probably play chess, have a conversation, and watch television all at the same time. That kind of naturalness that we're talking about.
Now, you have, in this paper, you mentioned six criteria, six measurements to determine whether something is instinctive or something is natural, like playing basketball, like grabbing something or walking. I want to go through those and walk through those. Can you give us an idea of what those characteristics are?
Sure. Yeah. Well, what Macaulay does, and what I sort of steal from him, is but then he says, look, there's that sort of basic sense of naturalness, but then there's what he calls maturationally natural. And that's cumbersome, that mm-hmm. term, maturationally natural stuff. So I'm just going to call that natural. And then he distinguishes maturationally natural from practiced natural. Well, that's kind of an awkward term, too. Sorry, Bob. But we'll just call that expertise. Mm-hmm. Shooting the jump shot, that's expertise. Chess playing, that's expertise. I want to contrast that, as does he, with what I'm just going to call natural. These are modes of expression or abilities that have, as you say, six sorts of features that help mark them out. One is that you don't need a lot of explicit instruction, or tuition, sometimes called, to acquire this trait. No one has to explicitly lay out for you. Look, so suppose we're talking about walking, because you can have naturalness in, you know, in skill domain like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no one says, well, when you walk, you put one foot in front of the other, and then, well, I guess except for that Christmas special that they play every year.
Well, they do teach you, yeah, that, yeah. But that's if you're a toy.
That's right. Or, well, yeah. or an old warlock who's been frozen in ice. Or
oh, that's
like
right.
That. But yeah, for most of us, no, that's not how children learn how to walk. They just walk. They don't need to be explicitly taught the step-by-step how to walk. Likewise, when we speak our native language, we aren't taught the grammar of it. Here's how you conjugate the verbs, and here's how you do agreement between the form of the verb and the object. I don't know, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You learn with a second language. In your first language, you don't get all that. So you don't need that kind of explicit instruction or tuition. So that's sort of the first feature to look for.
Okay.
Another feature to look for is the presence of culturally specific artifacts, man-made stuff, human-made things that are required. If it's expertise, you probably need, or there's a good chance you're going to need special artifacts or something to get this off the ground. If you're going to be a chess master, you need a chessboard at one point in your development. If you're going to be really good at riding a bicycle, even though that might come natural to you at a certain point, that would be expertise, you need a bicycle. But you don't need any special man-made sort of things to walk, to speak your native language, to understand that 1 + 1 = 2. Those kinds of, that kind of naturalness, the kind that I want to focus on, doesn't seem to require those sorts of things. Are we good so far?
Yeah, so it's good. And one of the things that you mentioned too, and you use a really nice analogy as to music, is that people across the planet, whether you're in Pasadena, California, or Russia, or Australia, people enjoy music. They have an innate sense of music that is in there. So, I mean, this is, again, you know, your first criteria here, little or no need for explicit tuition. You just kind of know something about music. And then there's no need for culturally specific artifacts. You start humming. You start enjoying the sound of rhythm and melody. What's the third thing here?
So then the third feature we'd look for is, well, how early does it typically develop in life? Usually, not always, but usually these natural, or maturationally natural traits are things that develop so early we don't remember not having them. Sometime, you know, before age 6, age 5, really early. So most of us don't remember not being able to walk. It's almost impossible. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say it is impossible to remember when it is you couldn't use your native language.
Mm-hmm.
You don't remember learning language. You don't remember learning how to walk because it comes in so early.
Mm-hmm.
But you do remember learning how to ride a bicycle. You do remember being taught how to play chess, if you know how to play chess, and some of these other kinds of things. You know, going back to the example of music, you don't remember when it is you thought, oh, wow, music, that sounds cool. Or, ooh, I've just learned how to hum.
Right.
That's just been there so long. Now, I did say typically develops early in life because there are a couple of unusual ones, unusual traits that seem to be maturationally natural but come in a little bit later, a little bit like the way that wisdom teeth grow late in life, but they're still, you know, a natural kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those behaviors are related to reproductive kinds of behaviors, of course.
But, right, right.
But it's got a different timetable.
Yep.
Just as a footnote to that kind of early development, I'd also add to Macaulay's sort of list, these are his list of features, but one that I'd like to add to it is that these are also traits that have been around human beings for an awful long time. So they're early developing in terms of our history or prehistory as well.
Yeah, that is one of the characteristics that you add in. You say that there's little variation historically, that if we looked at a baby or an infant today and they start humming, they start walking, they start grabbing for things instinctually, that was true 1,000 years ago and maybe even 30,000 years ago or deeper into history.
That's right. And that's another clue that maybe we're dealing with something very natural here. Is that kind of early development. It's been with humanity an awful long time.
Now, two of the other characteristics that you mentioned, too, are fascinating because it really ties together our entire humanity. You mentioned that there is very little intra-group variation in some of these instinctive characteristics, as well as very little inter-group variation. What do you mean by that, intra-group and inter-group variation?
What I have in mind here is that for a lot of traits that, you know, any one person might be really good at.
Mm-hmm.
Let me stick with music. You've got a virtuoso violinist. Well, in any given group of people, people in where I'm living here in Pasadena, California, some people are really good at the violin, and some people are really lousy at the violin. For some people, playing the violin has that kind of ease, automaticity, fluency that characterizes cognitive naturalness. They have expertise, I would say. Whereas others just have none of that. So there's a lot of variation within a group of people. In this case, I'm thinking about people in Pasadena for those kinds of abilities. But for being able to speak and understand your native language, well, it sure doesn't look like there's the same kind of variation. There seems to be a lot less within a group of people. Even though people from Pasadena speak, 100 different languages, it's a very cosmopolitan, diverse kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you wouldn't say, some people in Pasadena just are better at their native language and other people are at their native language. It's just a funny thing to say. So there's not a whole lot of intra-group variation normally on these kinds of natural traits. And the other that you mentioned is intergroup variation. Of course, this is across cultural groups. And draw the lines wherever you like. Once again, it makes perfect sense to talk about, people from Singapore being really good at calculus
mm-hmm.
compared to, say, people from, the United States even. It wouldn't be dopey for somebody to make the claim that people from Singapore are better at that.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go, we might grumble about it, feel uncomfortable, but it's not a strange thing to say. But it would be a strange thing to say that that people from Singapore are just better at walking or better at their native language than people from the United States. That would be a very strange thing to say, and I think most of us would have that intuition.
Yeah.
Why? Because there's just not that very much variation across cultural groups.
When I was reading this, I thought about laughing, too. It just seems to be all across the globe that when people experience pleasure, they laugh, and that's pretty common everywhere around the globe.
Yeah.
And so that has that kind of intergroup variation.
And back to music, right? I mean, we see music everywhere. The particular form of musical expression might be different, but that people express themselves musically seems to be across culturally.
And there's no culture that doesn't have some form of music, whether it be, string instruments or rhythmic tapping on drums or something.
Right. So if we tick through these different criteria, we can see that something like at least basic music sense, musicality, an attraction to music, maybe even a basic production of music, seems to be largely natural. Right? You don't need that explicit tuition. You don't need culturally specific artifacts. It develops early in life, it develops early historically, and there's not a lot of intra-group variation or inter-group variation. So it seems to have a lot of the marks of being natural. That doesn't mean that any particular kind of musical expertise, like violin playing, is natural in the same regard. That kind of thing can, well, looks more like an instance of expertise.
Yeah, and that you link to the, to some extent, the unnaturalness of some activities, where this is where culture comes in, and you talk about how culture can somehow tune up some of these natural instincts, that we all enjoy music, or we all have some sense of music, but there are some people who really find ways to, as you say, tune that up and become the virtuoso on the piano or the violin.
Right. When it comes to certain kinds of cultural expression, certain ways of thinking and behaving, yeah, it's going to take special conditions or special personal traits as well. Maybe extra effort, extra time invested in those kinds of activities, and probably that extra, what I've called cultural scaffolding. So here, cultural scaffolding can be things like, well, you know, musical instruments, access to schools, formal institutions. This is where your institutions come in, too, right?
Right.
Specific institutions that have been developed for, say, training people up in a particular trait. Those are forms of cultural scaffolding that not everybody around the globe has access to, right? And so those help move people away from these natural tendencies to less and less natural kinds of endpoints.
Now, I want to abstract a little bit away from what we're talking here, specifically music. We use as an example, we used language. We also used walking as an example. And you folks in the field of cognitive development have seen several aspects of early childhood development that seem to be rather instinctive, these kind of broader abstract categories, and several which you consider to be natural instincts. And it becomes important for understanding religious belief here. And here I'm thinking about what you talked about in terms of naive physics, agency detection, theory of mind, and a few other things. And I want you to go into that, because those seem to be really critical pieces to the puzzle for understanding why religion is so natural. So if we just go down and kind of check these things off, what do you mean by naive physics, and why is that natural to or instinctive to a little toddler?
Sure, yeah. Let me step back just one little step.
Okay.
I think it's a common misconception that a lot of folks have that humans come into the world and are essentially blank slate.
Yeah.
When it comes to the way that their minds develop, that pretty much everything is up for grabs depending on your cultural context. And while culture certainly can powerfully shape people, it's certainly not the case that everything's up for grabs. And some of these studies on, say, naive physics, I think are some of the best cases, really convincing cases, that, no, children come into the world with sort of predilections already. Or, if you will, their human nature plus the regularities of the human environment lead to certain, predictably, almost inevitably, lead to certain kinds of thinking and certain kinds of behavior. Okay, that's by way of backdrop. But what's this naive physics? This is a label for the kind of intuitive folk thinking we do about physical objects in our environment. And there's really good evidence now over the past 25, 30 years. There have been all of these really clever experiments with babies, with infants, with 3, 4, 5 month olds, looking at what are their expectations about the properties of physical objects? What do they seem to think is going on? Okay, and you might wonder, well, how in the world to get in the head of a 3-month-old or a 4-month-old? Because you can't just ask them, so what do you think about this? And they just sort of gurgle back at you. That doesn't work. So what scientists have done is they play off of really subtle behavioral kinds of cues, like where the baby's eyes go. You know, what are they looking at? And if you give them 2 displays and they look at one more than the other, you know, 2 displays at the same time, but they seem to prefer, it's called preferential looking, look at one more than the other, you know at least they can tell a difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we know that if you give babies something to look at for too long, they get tired of it. They get bored. They start squirming and fussing and looking all over the place. And so once you get on board with something, in the field they call this habituation, they get sort of into the habit of looking at the thing until they get tired, then you can show them something new, and if it recovers their attention, they start looking at it again, you can infer that they see this as importantly different in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So using those kind of tricks, then people have devised these really clever experiments showing things like, at least by about 5 months of age, babies seem to appreciate that physical objects move all together as a bounded whole. If I grab the handle of my coffee cup, the whole cup goes with it. It doesn't disintegrate. My coffee cup can't pass through a solid wall. For it to move from one place to another, it has to go through the space in between. Okay, it can't just teleport from one place to another.
Uh-huh.
That in order for it to move, some other physical object has to come into contact with it. It can't just launch itself and start moving around the room. That would be very surprising. So there are all of these expectations that babies have that constitute this domain that we call naive physics.
And again, that's very instinctual. We just tend to pick that up. In part, maybe because just as human species, we need to figure out why things are moving, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, this can certainly be a function of learning,
right,
of what's in there, but it happens to be a kind of learning that doesn't change across culture. They're not picking it up on the basis of testimony or folktales or stuff. It's just observing the way the physical world works, and the physical world works the same place pretty much everywhere, right?
So, right.
It's regular in that sense. And that kind of understanding of physical objects, though, then sets the backdrop for all kinds of other learning that goes on. Because it turns out there's this other class of things out there that do move themselves,
mm-hmm,
that don't have to be physically contacted in order to start moving around the room.
And that's what you're meaning when you're getting into this issue of agency detection?
That's right.
Yeah.
So this is agency detection. So the backdrop is babies see, I see physical objects around me, says the baby in the crib, and I have expectations about them. They don't move themselves, yada, yada. But here are these objects that do move themselves, that seem to launch themselves, and they go around moving other things as well. Those, in the jargon, we call agents.
Mm-hmm.
I think of these as, well, people are our best example, but they can include things like, remote control cars or animals or all kinds of things. But they're things that move themselves, that violate at least some of those expectations.
And later on, we're going to get into this because people have this innate sense of this agency detection. And we're coming up on Halloween here, too. And one of the things that you make mention of is possibly of ghosts, that we have this sense that something is around us. And you want to talk a little bit about that now in terms of agency detection?
Sure. At least some folks in this area have produced evidence, mostly through lab experiments, that humans from infancy, but even adults, have a very sensitive agency detection system.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it doesn't take a whole lot for us to wonder whether or not something is an agent or whether some event has been caused by an agent as opposed to just brute physical kinds of action. So you can think of, we are coming up on Halloween, you know, I imagine being alone at home in a creepy old house. The wind is blowing and you hear creaking on the stairs. Your mind probably goes first to who's there.
Right, right.
Not, oh dear, the timbers are settling and that's causing boards to rub together, which causes a squeaking noise. That's not where our minds go first. Our minds seem to go very quickly to who's there. Is there an agent nearby?
And then, and thinking about that too, and you make this very clear when you talk about something in the dark at night, that there tends to be this human quality that we're a little bit more leery at night. Wherever culture you go, things that go bump in the night, it seems to be a theme around the world.
Yeah, well, there certainly seem to be different certain conditions under which our agency detection system sort of ramps up and it becomes more hair triggered. It's a rate of fire. And maybe it's in those situations where it's harder to know what's going on around us.
Yeah.
We can't see things as well. It's dark. And maybe where it might be more important to to err on the side of detecting agents as opposed to missing them.
Yeah, as you mentioned that in the paper, that, you know, way back in our prehistory, that it was better to have that hair trigger of being very cautious when you sense something around you, because if you don't have that, you get eaten up by a saber-toothed tiger. If you do, as you call them, have these false positives where you think something's around you, but there really isn't, well, that's okay then. You still don't get eaten. But the worst case scenario is you get eaten by the saber-toothed tiger.
That's right. So at least arguably, this system has evolved in a way to be a little bit hair-triggered, because it's better to falsely detect something that's not there instead of failing to detect a real threat in the environment. But it's not just with threatening things. It could also be with positive things. Imagine you're out lost in the woods, and you need to find signs that there are other humans around who could maybe save you from your plight. Well, then it would be very good to be sent, you know, sort of, it's better to go, oh, hey, this could be a evidence that someone has been here. There's a path nearby, or somebody has set up stones as a marker or something like that. Signs of agency. They're really important to pick up on, or you could be lost in the woods for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So for these kinds of reasons, it's suspected that the system is probably tuned slightly in the direction of making more false positives than false negatives, kind of errors, if you will. And at least some folks, some of my colleagues have argued that that perhaps makes this device really likely under some circumstances to at least generate the possibility that, hey, there's an agent nearby. It sure doesn't look like a human. Or it sure doesn't look like any animal I know about. I wonder what it is.
Well, let me move you to the next one here. And that is one I had a little bit more difficulty understanding. And that's this theory of mind. What is that category of instinctiveness that we have as young infants or children?
Yeah, theory of mind is unfortunate jargon that refers to how it is we think about and reason about other people's minds, how their beliefs, desires, their perceptions, how those motivate their behavior. So again, when we see somebody... say somebody just walks up to a chair and sits down. You say, why did they sit down? We don't say, gravity. Nothing was supporting their butt, so they had to fall into the chair. I mean, that's not the way we think about it. We don't think of them as brute objects. We think, no, they wanted to sit down, or they were tired, and so they decided to sit down. In both of those answers, they wanted to or he decided to, I'm appealing to mental states. I'm appealing to what the mind is doing. And so there's been this... the real industry in the cognitive development area called theory of mind research, where it's looking at how does that theory of mind system that we see in adults, how does it develop in childhood? And it's wild, because at different ages you get really different kinds of looks on this that might be surprising from an adult perspective. So for instance, what's at least a lot of people have regarded as a watershed event in theory of mind development is understanding that people's beliefs can be false.
Mm-hmm.
We take this for granted as adults. Yeah, somebody can be wrong in what they believe to be the case. Of course they can. But there was a time where it sure looks like we didn't understand that. And the one way you can look at this is through what's sometimes called a false belief task. So a task that I've used in my lab is called a surprising content task. False belief task. And what you do is you present people with a familiar container. Some of my early studies, it was a cracker box, a saltine cracker box.
Mm-hmm.
And you show little kids the cracker box, and you ask, well, what's inside this box? And they're not dumb. They can see that it's a cracker box. So they say, crackers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a sensible thing to guess what's inside the cracker box. And then what you do is you open the box and show them that you've taken out the crackers and you've put some surprising something. I put rocks in mine. So, look, there are rocks in the box. Oh, yeah, there are rocks in there. Okay, I'm going to close the box back up again. Can you see inside the box? No. Good. What kind of box is it? It's a cracker box. What's inside the box? Rocks. That's right. There are rocks in the box. Now, if your mom came in right now and she saw this closed box for the first time, what would she think is inside the box?
She'd think they're crackers.
That's what an adult would say. They'd say crackers. And most 5-year-olds will say that. But most 3-year-olds won't. those three-year-olds will say, rocks. She thinks there are rocks in the box. And, you know, try it out sometime, with parents' permission, of course. Push back at them a little bit. She would think there are rocks in this cracker box? Yep. Well, why would she think that? Because there are rocks in the box. But it's a cracker box, yeah? What's this picture on the side of the box? Crackers. What's normally inside of a cracker box? Crackers. So what would she think is in this box? Rocks. Most three-year-olds just can't get past the fact that they know that there are rocks in the box. And so they assume that other people are going to know that too. In fact, you can even ask them if they ever thought there were crackers in this box. And most of these kids will say no, they never did.
Wow.
Even though they just said it.
Yeah. No, that's a kind of surprising experimental result.
It is. It's wild. But one of the things that, you know, sort of struck me and some of my student collaborators when we were working on this stuff was, gee, this sounds a whole lot like the way, at least in some religious traditions, people talk about gods.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, gods would know what's inside the cracker box, too, because they're all-knowing or they can see through walls or whatever it is. They would know. And so then the child, you know, at that age, a three-year-old, if they were answering this question about a god, they'd be getting it right.
Yeah. And that's interesting, yeah.
And so, I mean, this is one of the things we decided to go ahead and then test out, because at that time, the conventional wisdom was, until kids are about 8, 9 years old, all they can do is treat gods like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even if that's right, that means treating God as a human being, well, if the three-year-olds assume everybody has these sort of infallible beliefs, then they're going to be getting their gods right and their humans wrong. And that's kind of weird. It turns out we've got evidence now. It looks like kids don't have to treat their gods as humans, but it looks like it's a little bit easier for them to just keep going with this developmental default or this bias, which is to over-attribute knowledge, over-attribute perceptual access to what's inside of containers or what's hidden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get too technical, but I mean, it sure looks like it's easy. The kids start by sort of attributing super knowledge and super perception to everybody,
mm-hmm.
gods and humans and animals. And then they have to learn how to pair that back for different animals, humans. But if you've got a super knowing god in your cultural sort of environment, well, that one's easy. I don't have to learn anything particularly new there.
Right, right.
It just maps on to sort of my initial expectations. So it looks like it might actually be easier for kids to get at least some gods right than understanding when it is a dog knows something and doesn't, or when it is mom knows something and doesn't. So that's kind of a surprising little finding.
That is. There's one last one here I want to spend a little bit of time with, not too much, but it has a really kind of awkward name, and you call it teleofunctional reasoning biases. What are those things?
Oh. Yeah, that's quite a mouthful. Here I'm really just appropriating insights by Deborah Kellerman at Boston University. She's done just dozens of really well-crafted experiments with children and recently adults, looking at how people account for features of the natural world, how they make sense of them, how they understand them. And she's got evidence that sure looks like people have this natural tendency to gravitate toward explanations that refer to something's function or purpose. And that's what this teleofunctional reasoning is referring to. Is if I see, I've got palm trees outside my window here, you know, and if somebody was drawing my attention to, well, why is the palm tree shaped the way that it is? I'm probably going to produce an answer that's based on its function or its purpose. So, well, it's shaped like that so that it sways in the wind. Or it shapes like that because it's good for nesting birds. You know, when the scientists in the room at that point start cringing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they would say, well, actually, no, strictly speaking, it's shaped that way because of, I don't know, there are lots of ways to tell the story, because of developmental processes, because of genetic concerns, because of physical constraints. There are all kinds of stories you tell. And at least technically, we're not supposed to fall back on the sort of functional purpose reasonings, because no, it's not for that. So Kellerman has these cute little studies with children, like showing the picture of pointy rocks and saying, well, why are the rocks pointy? Well, so animals won't sit on them and crush them. Or, you know, where did the first ever river come from? You know, why did the first ever river appear? Well, so we had a place to go fishing. These are the kinds of things that that children generate. We have a strong, from early child, have a strong tendency to like those kinds of, what's it for?
Yeah, and the fact that it has a very intentional purpose to it.
That's right. It's easy to connect purpose then to, well, someone intended that purpose.
Yeah.
And she's shown that too, that children have this tendency.
You know, in terms of religion too, I mean, we all tend to look for meaning in life. And this is really interesting to see that, you know, a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old is looking for a meaning in that river. Not that it's just a bunch of water that flowed down that way because of gravity, but because there's a bigger purpose. There's some meaning to that river.
That's right. You've got that just right. And I want to just highlight, this isn't something we simply outgrow as a natural part of maturation. Kellerman's got some real recent experiments that show it's still there in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we learn to tamp it down.
Yeah, there's this
overriding.
There's this great quote that you have, and I want to connect this to religion. You say that the teleological reasoning biases, or this desire to have meaning in our life, persist into adulthood and appears to be only tamped down to a degree by formal education. And when I read that, I said, I started thinking about college students when they go to, especially a secular university, they, you know, they kind of get all that God stuff beaten out of them. What do you mean meaning to life? Here's a bunch of atoms that come together and that's what it is.
Well, I think that's, yeah, you're not far off from that. I mean, there's a, at least some of the sciences are going to do. Well, let's take natural selection, you know, evolution by natural selection. At least most proponents, most champions of natural selection, and I'm not criticizing natural selection at this point, I'm just, you know, just an observation. What gets hammered into kids is it's not directed. It's not purposeful. It doesn't have ends in mind. There's no intention behind it. And those are claims that fly directly against our intuitions about the natural world. And so that produces a little bit of tension there.
Yeah, no, that's a very good observation, one to, you know, think about in terms of the evolution debate, which is not where I want to go with this podcast. But here's the big question. Here's the really big question, is given all this cognitive psychology stuff, we've talked a lot about the theory of mind, the teleological function stuff of children and all these things about naturalness. Why is religion a natural instinct for humans? And how do we go about empirically knowing that?
How do we know? In some ways, what we're trying to do is really make an inference to the best explanation here, I think. It sure seems to bear a lot of the marks of these kinds of forms of expression we call natural. So we talked about those 6 criteria for what's something that's natural. We talked about sort of basic musicality as looking pretty darn natural on those 6 dimensions. But if you apply the same checklist to religious expression, and we don't mean the institutions, and I don't mean theologizing, I mean sort of religion on the ground, the basic intuition that there's someone's out there providing meaning, structure, maybe that there's an afterlife, maybe that, you know, there's more to this than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Kinds of ideas. Those appeals to intentional agents that account for things, super knowers, disembodied agents, I don't, whatever you like, gods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, do kids need explicit tuition to pick up those intuitions? Sure doesn't look like it. That is, much like language, they just need to be around it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need to learn catechism when they're 2 or 3 years old to be convinced and persuaded of this and get it all straight. It just seems to come in. Now, that one, that's a tough case to make. Some people would say, well, it's just they're so rigorously indoctrinated.
Yeah.
That's what's going on. But in a lot of traditional societies, actually, children are excluded from the religious rituals and stuff. You know, at best, they're going to overhear what the adults are talking about. But oftentimes, these are sort of our secret societies with initiations. And yet, the kids still pick this stuff. And we have intriguing little anecdotes by people like Helen Keller, who at least she claimed that, you know, before she learned how to communicate with the outside world, she was already wondering about who did it.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't have been taught there's a creator God, and that's why she was wondering that stuff. So it sure looks like that there's little or no need for explicit tuition for the basic religious impulses to get going.
Yeah, and the other fascinating aspect of this is that this transcends culture. It transcends differences within groups, within cultural groups. And to meet your last criteria, it seems that we've had this since time immemorial.
That's right. I mean, folks are thinking, you know, we've probably had religious practices of one sort or another for 50, 70, maybe even more, thousands of years. You're right. Very little intergroup variation, very little intergroup variation, typically developed so early in life we don't remember not having it. In fact, a lot of people who say, no, I've never had religion, they've just forgotten it because they had it so early.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't need artifacts. All of these are hints. And then what this field of research, this cognitive science of religion area has been doing is trying to identify, well, what are those basic cognitive mechanisms like agency detection, theory of mind, teleological reason, that we have good experimental evidence that is there from early childhood. Well, which of those mechanisms then seem to give support to or encourage these kinds of religious beliefs?
You know, one thing that just occurred to me, and this is somewhat of a tangent, and you know, I'm throwing you a little bit of a curveball here, but in thinking about this, and we use the example of music much earlier, it just seems, given that music is very much one of these innate instincts that we have, music is often always connected with religion in almost every culture that I can think of. I mean, has anybody thought about that, that there's these two instinctive things we have and they tend to be really connected a lot?
Well, at least one story about why they might get joined up is that, both of them have this social component to them. Music is something you can do with someone else, and if you do it with someone else, it's that much better.
Yeah.
That much better. And religion is something you do with someone else. And maybe the act of doing music together, and maybe particularly in these contexts, actually helps bind groups, helps form community. My now former colleague at Oxford, Robin Dunbar, talks about social grooming. There are different activities that what we see in non-human primates. They sit around and pick bugs out of each other and, you know, brush each other's body hair. Fortunately, we don't do that, at least not much. But we do other things that are sort of forms of social grooming that seem to release endorphins, which are sort of happy chemicals that, you know, help us form intimate bonds with each other.
Right.
It seems that religious rituals of various sorts and music of various sorts actually both do that. So there might be sort of a deep synchrony between these two kinds of activities. But you're right, this is sort of an interesting frontier still for research.
Well, that's what we like to do on Research on Religion, not only explain things, but also suggest new topics for some graduate student who's out there and needs a dissertation topic. So there's a
needs to be had.
Yeah, big, huge gold nugget there sitting waiting for you. Now we talked about the naturalness of religion. And the other thing that you talk about is the unnaturalness of theology. And what do you mean by theology being unnatural?
Yeah, right. If we take theology to be this sort of intellectual reflective exercise on this religious stuff, it doesn't seem to fit the sort of 6 points of the 6 features for naturalness. It's a very peculiar activity. Not everybody does it. If they do it, they do it at different degrees and intensities and levels of sophistication. Doesn't typically develop early in life.
Mm-hmm.
Often does need special cultural conditions to get going, like writing systems. for at least memory systems for remembering dogma or doctrine, even schools and institutes for challenging each other's ideas. In some ways, it's a rarefied and therefore a more unnatural kind of activity. And one of the things that theologians deliberately try to do is challenge their intuitions and see if they can go beyond them and make new discoveries that aren't quite so obvious. And, you know, let me rephrase that as not quite so natural in a way. So that's what I'm trying to get at with theology. Theology seems to require a whole lot more than basic religion. Sure, it draws on those religious instincts at a certain level. But here the analogy with music, I think, is a good one as well. Basic musicality, like basic religion, is largely a natural kind of outspringing of our ordinary psychological faculties, working in ordinary kinds of social environments. But particular, instrumental music expertise on the musical side, or theological expertise on the religious side, sure looks like it requires a very special kind of cultural condition or cultural scaffolding, and can be anything but intuitive and natural. It can be very counterintuitive, right? Some of the theologies that people develop, they make my head hurt. I
mean, and I'm with you there. And for me, this is a really interesting part. And when I was reading about the unnaturalness of theology, the wheels in my head started turning as somebody who studies religion from a political economy perspective, focusing on institutions. You know, you have the notion that religion or religious belief is natural, then theology is unnatural. And as you say, you oftentimes get theologians coming up with counterintuitive things. In fact, in many ways, the academic world awards you if you can come up with something very counterintuitive. And so you see a lot of this in divinity schools and seminaries, where you get this, in many ways, overthinking of these intuitions. And that oftentimes leads to a lot of schisms. This is what causes theological controversies, and you tend to see this throughout history, is that there's these rebellions, these schisms about, you know, our theology has taken us away from the true religion, and we need to get back to the fundamentals. And you had a story about this, and I think this was from one of the other scholars, I think somebody named Sloan, I might get that wrong, but talked about the issue of Calvinism versus Arminianism in the Great Awakening.
Well, I'm stepping out a little bit from my expertise. You're right. This is Jason Sloan's work. He has a nice little book called Theological Incorrectness, where basically he makes the point that theologians oftentimes find themselves pulling against sort of the folks' intuitions, religious intuitions, in many cases in developing their theology. And it creates, well, tough situations where people are going to systematically get your theology wrong, or they're going to misunderstand it in some way. And so his example there is Calvinism, where our sense that we are free will beings making our own decisions about things like whether or not we're going to be followers of Jesus or whatever it is, are so strong, so natural, that this idea that we are predestined for heaven or hell by, you know, God's machinations, it just strikes us as so counterintuitive that it's just hard to swallow. And it's hard to understand. Even, you know, some theologians can do some really clever work in putting it together and explaining how these two ideas can fit together and so forth. But it's just so unnatural, counterintuitive, that we don't get it.
Yeah, and I have that all the time. In fact, I don't consider myself to be a good theologian in any way, shape, or form. And one, the issue that we're just talking about here, this tension between predestination and free will, and, you know, much of the evangelical tradition that I'm in now has this Calvinist background. And man, do I struggle with that. And I will go up to various theologians and pastors and say, okay, here's my problem. Will you kind of explain this thing to me? And I'll give them examples of that. And I 10 minutes or 15 minutes later, I leave the room and I say, okay, I got it. You know, I understand this. It's just like taking a college class. I took down all my notes. And then a day later, I had no clue. Wait, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, I sure have that that feeling sometimes too. Yeah, I want to make sure that it's clear, though. I'm not saying that just because something is relatively unnatural or counterintuitive, it's wrong or bad. In fact, it might be better than the natural stuff.
No, that might just like training a virtuoso in violin.
That's right.
Yeah,
that can be, while it's unnatural, it might be beautiful and a real accomplishment. So, I don't want those categories getting confused here. But what it does suggest for, is what one of my colleagues in the area, Pascal Boyer, has called the tragedy of the theologian. And that there's always going to be that tension. And there are always going to be people who, as you say, as the theology gets further and further away, and as the sort of academic system rewards more and more innovation or movement away from these sort of natural anchor points, at a certain point, there's probably a tipping point where the folk just go, whoa, you guys have gone off the deep end and are just talking gobbledygook nonsense. And the poor, especially the pastor, that kind of a theologian, who has to give sermons, has to walk this fine line, right?
Yeah.
Between responding to the best theology has to offer and making it accessible to the masses who don't have all of the time to, study and reflect and do the philosophy and the historical studies that are necessary to make sense of these kinds of concepts. They need something that just fits their cognitive systems a lot better.
You know, and one of the things, one of the areas of research that I've become increasingly interested in is this issue of denominationalism, how denominations form and how they schism, how they break apart or disintegrate at times. And I've always thought of this as a political economist in terms of institutions and interests that, certain priestly class arises and they have very strong interest in conforming to the academic world where counterintuitiveness is rewarded. And so they start talking the academic jargon, but the common folk, the people in the pews, don't really quite understand it. I now, through your work, and this is why I love this work so much, now I have a cognitive psychological aspect or way to understand this is that, there's this intuitiveness that we have. And as you say, a good word there, term is tipping point, that when theologians push this beyond a certain point, when the denomination becomes so complex and perhaps convoluted that it does not mesh very well with our intuitions, people just pick up and leave.
That's a fascinating suggestion. I think there you've put your finger on another PhD to be had.
I might want to claim that one for my own because I'm interested in this. So I'm going to copyright that here, and maybe there's some at some point we can collaborate on something like that. I want to finish off here. We got 5 or 6 minutes left here. One of the things that you do at the end of this paper is you draw 5 implications for all this research that I think is really interesting, and the first one really hits hard at what we would call the secularization thesis, which the idea is that religion, as modernity progresses, religion is going to fade away. And so talk about that, one of the implications of your cognitive psychological development work, that religion is resilient.
Yeah, I think that insofar as religion is relatively natural form of cultural expression, a cultural context has to tamp it down or deliberately override these kinds of intuitions. So it's not just going to drift away if suddenly we close down the churches. If we try to tell people, look, we don't want to hear about your religion, which of course has been tried in various places.
In the Soviet Union, right.
And guess what? Religion doesn't go away.
Yeah.
It might hide, it might take on different form, but it doesn't go away. Now, theology might suffer without the institutions, but religion on the hoof is going to be resilient because of its naturalness.
Mm-hmm. For me, that's interesting, and I want to probe you on this because you just spent some time at Oxford. You were out there in Britain, and that's one of the places that secularization theorists hold up as a hallmark of, religion is fading away because nobody's going into the Church of England anymore. And there's a scholar out there in Britain named Grace Davey who's done a number of studies where she's surveyed people, and she says, there's a difference between believing and belonging. And what you see in Europe is not a whole lot of belonging. People are not showing up on Sundays to fill the pews. But there is still a lot of believing. that is going out there. So somehow there's a mismatch between the public expression of religion in the churches and still this, what you would call this innate or natural sense of religion. Were you thinking about this when you were in Britain?
Yeah, well, it is palpable there. You know, and there you've got a cultural context where there's a state church and still certain official expressions of religion are part of the cultural fabric. But yet, you've got not a lot of bums in pews on any given Sunday. But one of the things that struck me living there, now this was, as an American living in Britain, the British, of course, say, wow, it must be a relief for you escaping that sort of hyper-religious place, the United States. Of course, they're not recognizing that the United States is really very much like the rest of the world, just not like Western Europe.
Right.
But I was struck by the sort of folk religion, you might even call superstition, that you see in the UK, that in some ways is much, much greater than what you see in the United States. So this is of a, I was talking to a sociologist of religion, Rodney Stark, about this. And he has been one who's challenged the secularization thesis, as you probably know. And his response to this was, well, look, the church attendance in Britain in the last 30 years has gone down precipitously. At the same time, belief in ghosts has doubled. We could also add, and there's been a rise in astrology. Mm-hmm. There's been a rise in neo-paganism of various sorts, most of them fairly idiosyncratic, personal, invented kinds of religions. So it's not that suddenly, religion just dies because the institutional support isn't there. No, it just finds different modes of expression. Those people who are happy to play this game might wonder, well, what kind of mode of expression is preferable?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make any judgments on that right now, but I know some people are really concerned with certain kinds of religions are good at holding social fabric together, and others maybe work in the opposite direction. I'm not sure that's right, but these are certainly some of the discussions that are going on.
It is, and I want to. You mentioned Rodney Stark, and I want to plug one of his books called Discovering Gods, which when I was reading your work, and I had read his book a couple years ago, and we'll link to it on our website, really meshes well together. He has this. He starts the premise of this book, Discovering God, saying, well, what if this stuff really is innate with us? What if it's really there? How does that change the way that we as social scientists, especially those of us who do the more institutional aspects of religion, how does that change our analysis? And so I recommend people pick up Stark's book as well as all of your other ones. The next implication I want to talk to, and this is interesting, and it might deal a little bit with what's going on in Europe, is the issue that theology requires special conditions to thrive. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean it requires at least sort of minimal cultural scaffolding. At least, to do this hard-hitting, very thoughtful kind of theology, you need schools of theology. You need maybe other kind of intellectual scaffolding, like philosophical systems. You certainly need writing. That one we take for granted now, but
right.
I shouldn't. Maybe it's a little too strong to say. Certainly you need writing, but you need something that at least fills that gap.
Well, we can do texting now. And we can create an app for theology. Yeah, we can do an app for theology or something.
And so what happens if those institutions disappear?
Mm-hmm.
That's the real question. In theology, a little bit like other academic pursuits, and I do count it as an academic pursuit, seem to works best in communities,
mm-hmm.
right? In a collegial collaboration to a certain extent, even if it's just telling each other how wrong we've got it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have those societies and those institutions where that kind of exchange takes place, that rare space, right, the ivory palace, you're probably not going to get very good products when it comes to the theology as well. Those are the kinds of things that I was hinting at there.
Now, one of the other implications that you talk about, and this relates to theology, which we're just talking about now, but it goes back to what we were talking about, the tension between the highly trained theologian and the person in the pews, is that you draw the implication that taught and received theology, those two different things, taught and received theology, will be in tension.
Yeah, I guess this is what we were talking about a little earlier, that at least I think the honest theologian is going to say, if they've got the pulpit, they're going to try to give their best version, their sort of truest version of how they see their theology. If they do, there's a pretty good chance it's just going to be awfully counterintuitive, and it's going to be either misunderstood, misremembered, or poorly received by folks. Not everybody, but as you say, they might say, "Oh yeah, that sounds just right." Walk away. If they're asked, "Well, can you reproduce that for me?" Not a clue. I can't do it because it's just too counterintuitive. It's too hard.
Yeah, I have to ask this. And now you are relatively new to Fuller. And Fuller's Seminary, very well-known seminary. I think it's associated with Presbyterianism, if I'm correct. Is that right?
It's ecumenical.
Ecumenical.
It is not attached to a denomination. It does boast being the largest non-denominational seminary in the world, I guess.
So here's my question for you, is how does that implication of taught and received theology will be in tension? I mean, there's a lot about the taught theology there. What your colleagues going, whoa, what are you saying here?
I guess what I'd be saying to my colleagues here, and you're right, I haven't been here long enough to have these discussions, is that they're going to have to be, well, just like any teacher, you've got to be mindful of your students and where they're coming from and what their presumptions are. Maybe there are some parallels to be drawn with the cognitive science and its implications for science education. So we very briefly mentioned sort of teleofunctional reasoning, whatever that stuff is. Seems to be in tension with the way that evolution by natural selection is taught. Well, this hasn't escaped the notice of cognitive scientists and science. And so they're recognizing that what they're trying to teach is importantly counterintuitive in some way. They're already scratching their heads and testing out ways of being more effective teachers so that they better accommodate where their students' minds are coming from. And I just think that's an important lesson for maybe some of my colleagues over in the School of Theology to bear in mind, and maybe something that we can work together on and trying to figure out, is if you think you've got a real truth here that needs to be communicated effectively, you've got to know what the equipment of your the cognitive equipment of your audience.
And that does go with the next implication that you have, which is some theologies are more natural than others. What would you have to say about that?
Well, I think this just follows from the other points that are raised.
Yeah.
If one really is motivated to keep moving in more and more novel, more and more counterintuitive directions, and other people just aren't so motivated, well, you're going to see differences in the naturalness of the theology.
Mm-hmm.
And different traditions, I think, reflect those differences as well. Let me give you just one little difference. Maybe I'm going out on a limb here. I take it that one way to read part of the New Testament, even, is that Jesus, at least at some points, was advocating a theology, and I think this could apply to the Apostle Paul, that was actually less natural on some points than what the audience had in mind. The sort of folk theology, maybe even the taught theology at the time.
Mm-hmm.
One instance would be all of this talk about grace.
Right.
This concept of grace maybe is pretty counterintuitive. The idea of sort of direct reciprocation, tit for tat, getting what you deserve, that's pretty intuitive stuff. The less natural, more counterintuitive idea might be unmerited favor,
mm-hmm.
being forgiven, a ridiculous number of times, 70 times 7 times, forgiving someone else.
Yeah.
That someone can be a sinner and just repent and that's it.
Cleans the slate.
Wipe clean.
Yeah.
You go, well, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's one of those other things too that I've often struggled with, and with theologically, it's a difficult concept for me. I understand the concept of grace, and we hear about it a lot in church. But I say, well, wait a minute. So this means we got these Ten Commandments: don't do all this stuff, do some of this, don't do that, and you know, if I do this stuff, but it's still okay because I got grace. Well, how does this all work together? And as a political economist who thinks about costs and benefits and weighing the calculations, I'm like, you know, this means I could live a decadent life and just, you know, thumbs up at the end and it's all good. And then my preacher says, no, you're missing the point a little bit. And I think I am at times. So,
yeah, these are tough ones to resolve.
Yeah.
I think again of the famous parable of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the elder brother, I'll leave it to your listeners to look it up. You know, the elder brother represents, I think, the sort of natural, intuitive sort of theology. Look, I've been good. I've been here the whole time, Dad. Why are you going to treat my reprobate younger brother better than me? That's how he feels about it. This is just an illustration of where some theologies, even within a single theological tradition, are likely to be more natural than others.
And I think it's also a good case to make, too, that we can't just toss theology overboard, that we really do have to think through some of these things because, you know, in my own tradition, it's not just a gut reaction, that faith is a thoughtful action. It is something that we live throughout our lives and need to be daily reminded of on a daily basis and be conscious of. And I think that might get at some of your very last point about the implications of all this research. And that one, we'll kind of close on that one. You make the statement that some revelations will have to wait. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Now, you know, with this comment, I was presuming that suppose I'm supposing that you're in a theological tradition, that you're committed to there really being some kind of transcendence out there, some intelligence that has something to say to us mere mortals, creatures. And we've got this cognitive equipment that just has certain predilections and biases that get us part of the way there, but have some real limitations. You can think of it as anchors with tethers. We're sort of tied down by these tethers. They put us in the right vicinity, but maybe don't get us all the way there. And so in a lot of the world's religious traditions, there's this idea of revelation, right? That God or gods or the prophets or whomever delivers more information that augments our sort of natural intuitions and reflections. If that's right, and if this sort of cognitive story I'm telling is right, that it takes certain cultural scaffolding to accept, to understand, to effectively use and transmit certain ideas. Well, I think it follows that certain unnatural ideas, even if they're good and true, require enough cultural evolution to prepare us for them. So if an idea is too complicated for us, you and I, sitting here having this conversation, who have ridiculous amounts of formal education, we've been, we're a little bit like pampered pooches, who have, you know, had the luxury of exercising our minds. We've learned language very well and how to write and read and reason and all of this other stuff. And they're still hard for us. Imagine what they've been like for your average person living 20,000 years ago. Real difficult. And so it's possible that some of these revelations just couldn't have got off the ground back then. I don't want to sound triumphalistic about us now. I'm trying to point to the fact that we all have limitations. And at least it sure looks to me like there's a case to be made that if a God knows what he's doing in these sorts of situations, you got to give the kids what they can handle at whatever stage of development they're at. That isn't to say that you lie to them when they're three and then you tell them the truth when they're five. You give them as much of the truth when they're three as you can and then a little bit more that they can handle when they're five. And so you might expect that kind of revelatory development, I guess, even in the course of humanity. At least from this perspective.
Yeah. Well, Justin, you have certainly given us a lot to think about, and your revelations about cognitive psychology have really inspired me to think about new ways that I experience my faith. And I want to thank you for doing that. And like I said, we will link to A number of your works, including Why Would Anyone Believe in God and your forthcoming book, Born Believers, The Science of Childhood Religion. And so, Justin, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.